Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. These messages are intended to spark your own reflections and conversations all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime along with other resources and ways to keep the conversation going at fabricmpls.com/scraps.
Good morning, Fabric. It is great to see you all here this morning. Yeah, what do you do on a rainy day? And welcome to all of our podcast listeners that are out there as well today. First of all, I have something to tell you. I've been telling you this when I started the last bunch of weeks. Some of you know what it is already. And it is this. You have permission to have hope. Okay? Oh, that seems like a dangerous thought these days. So many of us feel like we don't have permission to do it. And I want you to take that seriously. You have permission to have hope, all right? Now, you don't have permission to have hope just because that means, well, I don't have to do anything. I sure hope everything works out. I mean, that's not what we're talking about here. I think hope is, you know, that's wishful thinking, really. Hope is an active thing, even if it isn't certain. It's something that pulls us into the process and makes us try stuff. I mean, your permission to have hope is because you have the power to imagine the future and to breathe life into this world. You have the power to imagine the future and to breathe life into this world. And that is how future scapes are made, which is what we're talking about these whole 6 weeks of, you know, end of April and through May about these future scapes. Now, you may not know what future scapes are. Future scapes are simply this, and I've been given kind of a different definition each week. But a futurescaping is what you make out of what is, what you make out of what is so that what could be will be. All right? It's what you make out of what is so what could be will be. And that's an acting out of hope. Now, it's hard to live in that world because we see a different world so often. In fact, there's a lot of people that think that there's more hate, there's more hopelessness in the world than love. But here's my take on this, and you see if this doesn't make sense to you. If there were more hate in the world than love, then hate would be more the norm, and peace would be the exception, right? And as prevalent as war or violence and oppression are in our world, and yes, you know, they are, I think the truth is that peace, compassion, and love are actually the most common. I mean, the tough stuff, the violent stuff, stands out because it's such a stark exclamation mark. It's such a stark, point, a tipping thing that catches our attention. But the norm, the continual that's running around in the background, the ambient thing is this love, this compassion, this understanding, this tolerance, this acceptance that we have for one another. Sometimes it's in brave and stunning ways, and we see examples of that, but sometimes it's just in these simply happening. It's humble, it's innocent, it's unconscious, it's maybe almost unnoticeable. Remember, darkness does not have the ability to drive out light. Darkness is simply what is left when light isn't there, right? Light, on the other hand, does have the ability to drive out darkness. Be about light, and we can drive out darkness. Now, today we are talking about the light that is systems thinking. You might go, whoa, there's a jump. Yeah, and I hope you kind of start seeing it and start feeling the light, feeling the hope that is buried in this new way of looking at the world that sees things as systems, because I think it is a completely new and at the same time ancient perspective that is really helpful. And it really is a game changer because we spent a long, long time doing component thinking rather than systems thinking. That is when we deal with all the individual parts of our problems, ignoring the fact that they are all connected. You know, what we don't realize is that when I tug on this, I also then pull on that, which then affects that, and that list goes on and on. We think when we just deal with an issue and try to solve it that we are solving a problem, and sometimes sort of we are, but the funny thing is that often those problems don't seem to go away, they just come right back up. In fact, other problems that we didn't even know about beforehand start popping up because we were doing it that way, we were dealing with a component, not with the system. So we're going to get into the systems thinking more in just a minute, but here's how I want to define it, and this is on your Sunday papers as well. Systems thinking says that everything is part of a larger whole. Everything is a part of a larger whole, and the second part is really important. It cannot be truly or fully understood apart from that larger whole. Everything is part of a larger whole, and it cannot be understood apart from that larger whole. To put it simply, systems thinking says everything is woven. Everything is woven. Chris actually made up bumper stickers for your car or anything else. Are those around here somewhere, Chris? They're on the table. Yeah, if you want to get an Everything is Woven and put it on your Jetson mobile, go for it. But this is the truth. So now, like most forms of hope, systems thinking is really hard, all right? And what is wrong in our world is so visible that it blinds us to the possibilities that can be out there. We think our dilemmas are unique to us. Like, no one has ever done this before. Of course, it's going to overcome us. We don't see the challenges, the hopelessness that countless generations before us faced and somehow had the ability to imagine a future and speak life into it in a way that got us where we are today, as imperfect as where we are today. All right? But this has been going on. Our ancestors knew that we would have this problem, and so they gave us pictures of hope so that we could hold on to them as we face our own hopelessnesses and try to find our path through them into something greater. And so they tell us stories. Our ancestors left us stories. Why? Why did they leave us stories? It wasn't so that we would know how to solve it, all right? Or that we would, this is how they did it. Weren't they great? How, can't we do it as well as they did? They're not telling us for that reason. They aren't telling us so that we know it's already been fixed and we don't have to do anything about it. No, I mean, that's obviously not true. The problems, keep cropping up. They keep happening. We have to do it again. They're like weeds in the garden. They just keep coming up. No, they tell us these stories so that we will know how it works. So we will know how hope works, how change happens, how possibilities arise, because we need to know it for our generation so that we can face it in our world, in our time, in our lives. We need to have hope. We need to have hope that's born of vision, that is based in reality, that is motivated with determination and courage and curiosity. Now, one of the people who experienced this kind of storytelling of hope and then passed it on to us is this crazy prophet whose name was Ezekiel. Now, when you hear the word prophet, I mean, and the way we use that word today is like a predictor, right? Now, the prophets weren't that. The best way to understand a prophet is they are people who were burdened with a God's view of the world. They see things really, really big, and they can't keep their mouths shut about it. And obviously, then they get themselves into trouble, right? Because everybody wants to see it. We're component people, right? Not system people. We don't see the big picture. So they kept getting. And so Ezekiel's time was in one of the most difficult times of Israel's history, about 2,600 years ago now. All right, so Israel's been conquered. Everything's been destroyed. All the people are being carted off, into exile. And so, there's nothing left. This was one of the most hopeless times for Israel. And the story that I want to just share with you a little bit comes from Ezekiel chapter 37. It's actually our reading for this week. I would encourage you to spend some time with this reading because it's not the kind of thing you read this story and go, oh, that's an interesting story. No, this is one to live with for a long time to figure out what is actually being said in this because this is deep, right? Way beyond the surface. So let me tell you a little bit about, walk you through this story and then help you understand what this maybe has to do with systems thinking. So Ezekiel, this crazy guy, it starts out this way. It says, the hand of Yahweh came upon me. All right, now if you're new here, you're going to have to get used to this, all right? In the Bible, if you're in your Bible, it's going to say the hand of the Lord, and the Lord will all be capital letters, all right? When it says that, that's the way someone decided to translate the name of God. In the Old Testament, it's always Yahweh is that name. And what I like to change it is the Lord is like a title if you want to call a God. In the Bible, it actually says, no, this is my name. Call me by my name. It's Greg, right? Not the preacher guy, right? And what that name, Yahweh, means is equally important. It means I am who I am, all right? So the hand of I am who I am came upon me. I am who I am. I mean, what an amazing name. I mean, it speaks of like ultimate integrity, right? I am nothing but what I am, and everything that I am is in me, all right? It's that fabric of existence all woven together. Okay, so I took 5 minutes on the first line. The hand of Yahweh came upon me and brought me out by the Spirit of Yahweh and set me down in the middle of a valley. Okay, so he's on a trip here. I don't know what kind of mushrooms it was. But this is like some sort of... All right, edit that out. This is some sort of like transcendent, bizarre experience he's having here. So he sat down in the middle of a valley. It's full of bones. Yahweh led me all around them. There were very many lying in the valley, and they were very dry. These have been there a long time. Have been dead for a long time. And Yahweh said to me, "Mortal, can these bones live?" I love that, mortal. Literally, in Hebrew, it says, son of Adam. I mean, the contrast is, I am Yahweh. I am all things forever beyond anything you could ever imagine, and you are son of Adam. You are this mortal being. Can these bones live? And Ezekiel answers probably the way I would have. I don't know. You know. I mean, he's terrified. He knows it's a trick question. He doesn't know the right answers. I don't know, Yahweh, you know. And then Yahweh just ignores that, blows right by it. And Yahweh, I am who I am, says to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them. Prophesy to these bones and say to them. He isn't, again, a prophet to prophesy. It isn't predict the future. The best way to translate that is speak the future to these bones. Imagine the possibility and speak the future to these bones. And say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh to these bones, I will cause breath to enter you and you shall live. I will lay sinews upon you and I will cause flesh to come upon you and cover you with skin and put breath in you and you shall live. And you shall know that I am Yahweh. You shall know that I am who I am. If you want to make a point. So I prophesied as I had been commanded, and as I prophesied, as I spoke the future to those bones, suddenly there was a noise, a rattling, and the bones came together. Bone to its bone, I looked, and there were sinews upon them, and flesh had come upon them, and skin had covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then Yahweh said to me, prophesy to the breath, prophesy, mortal, and say to the breath, thus says Yahweh, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain that they may live. It might be worth remembering that the word for wind, the word for breath, the word for spirit are all the same word. Breathe upon these slain that they will live. And so I spoke the future. I prophesied as Yahweh commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they lived, and they stood on their feet, a vast multitude. Okay, now, wow, what a trip. I mean, who would have thought this? I mean, this is something out of some bizarre movie. But it wasn't about what he just experienced, was it? I imagine Ezekiel is now, the scene has ended. He's been whisked back to Israel in all of its misery, in all of its horror, where it is defeated and deflated, it is done, it is hopeless, and this it is what it's about. He gave him that vision of what had been so that he could face what will be. And this is what it's all about. Then Yahweh said to me, mortal, these bones are the whole house of Israel. These are your people. They say our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We are cut off completely. Remember that line, we are cut off completely. That is where our death, our hopelessness is found. Therefore, prophesy, speak the future to them. And so that's what he's going to be doing. And see, it hasn't been about what happened somewhere else at some other time. It never is, right? Those merely witness to what has been done before, so that in Ezekiel's case, he can do what he needs to do now, or so that you can do what you need to do now, or I can do what I need to do now, so that we can speak the future to the world around us and we can breathe life into the world around us. You, like many who have gone before you, have the ability, you have the power to imagine the future and to breathe life to the world. You, like many people before you, have the power to imagine the future and to breathe life into this world. And it doesn't happen all at once. It happens piece by piece, sinew upon bone, muscle upon sinew, skin upon muscle. It isn't a battle, it isn't a solution, but is a remembering of what we all part of, a reconnecting of what has been cut off completely, separated from what it is larger part, the system that it is integrally part of. And finally, after all that, breath. See, we aren't just woven together into whatever it is, you know, what came before me and what comes after me, but we are woven into all things, that which is beyond us. We are woven externally into all things, filled and connected with all things. The breath of I am who I am, the fabric of existence that surrounds us, is also woven into us and gives us life and makes us part of the one thing that this world really is all about. Do you feel that now? Can you take that breath and feel that you are more than you, but you are part of all things, and that matters more than anything else in your life or in this world? Systems thinking says that everything is part of the larger whole and cannot be understood apart from that larger whole. That is how the fabric of existence works. It isn't trillions of components sitting side by side. It is the inextricable connectedness of you and me and the world and of all things. But we're not good at that, are we? You know, we like to, I want to focus on one thing. That's too hard for me. And so this is on your outlines. It's so much easier to treat a symptom than it is to understand a system. It's so much easier to treat a symptom, one little thing, one component, than it is to understand a system and then try to integrate it. And so we, as a world, we play this wonderful game that maybe you have seen. Maybe you've done it someplace. The whole whack-a-mole thing, right? It pops up here, you pound it down. It pops up there, you pound it down. And when it runs out, you put another quarter in and you do it again. I mean, this is a perfect picture of society for us. The only thing is the cat's better at it than we are. But the easiest way to deal with the world is through its myriad components, right? But as we're learning today, more and more people are getting a bigger picture of the world. Okay. That can go on and on forever. I mean, we've been doing it for hundreds of years. How come we don't laugh at ourselves? But science, education, poetry, psychology, I mean, they're all helping us understand that our individuality is actually sort of an abstraction. I am not just me. I am me. I mean, if you want to know who I am, you need to know my wife, Chris. You need to know my kids. You need to know the house I live in. You need to know the passions, the interests that motivate me. You probably need to know where I grew up. I mean, I am not separable from that which surrounds me, that which is the larger part of this whole world. That's true for you, too. There is a Lakota phrase that Maya taught me this week as we were doing this, and I know I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but it's mitakwe oyasan. Mitakwe oyasan. And what it means is, all are related. It's sort of literal, or all my relatives, or really figuratively, what it really is trying to say is, all things are connected. And they use that like we use amen often in the church, right? And when you say something profound, or when there is a prayer, or there is something meditated, it's finished with mitakoe oyesan. All things are connected. It's the last thing to sum it up. Interesting, isn't it? When people must live embedded with the natural order without their mastery of it through technology, people tend to know that all things are connected, and they seek to live in the context that makes sense with all things being connected, rather than fighting it, rather trying to master it, to change it. And they fit into it. And we've gone so far from that in our technological era. But now, again, through technology, we're starting to discover that things are connected. We're seeing the bigger picture. We've gone deep enough that we found out that all the components we're discovering are only pieces of something much, much bigger that we need to understand as part of it. I think those are a lot of the bright spots we have. And one of those bright spots of systems thinking in science is around soil health. Now, yeah, I see a few heads go, what? Yeah, you know, I mean, that seems so basic, but did you know that there really wasn't even such a thing or a consideration as soil health about 40 years ago? No, it was just like, there's just soil. And you either have good soil, in which case you're lucky and you use it until you use it up and it's not good soil anymore and has become bad soil, or you had bad soil in the first place and, well, what do you do with bad soil? You pump stuff into it, right? You pump fertilizers, you pump herbicides and pesticides and water into it, and you use very specially designed seeds so that you can grow something. The soil is really just a medium. It's just a sponge that you put inputs into so they can get what you want out of it. Now, the Green Revolution of the 1960s, many of you have heard about that. It was actually championed by a guy named Norman Borlaug. He's from the University of Minnesota, right here. And the Green Revolution capitalized on that understanding of what can we add to the soil so that we can get enough food out of it to feed our planet, our hungry planet. And he got the Nobel Peace Prize for helping be the father of the Green Revolution, and he's credited with maybe saving up to 1 billion lives through doing that. So you've seen this component, a soil, and what do we have to pump into it to get enough out to feed a hungry planet? Now, the problem is, as David Montgomery, who I want to talk about a little bit today, started pointing out in just these last few decades, and that is seeing dirt just as dirt that either grows something or doesn't, misses what the land has known for millions of years. Believe it or not, the land has known how to grow plants before we invented fertilizers. In fact, it's incredibly good at it and does it without all the problems that we have created. He's realizing that there is a system here, a complex interrelationship that has managed to work very, very well, and adding inputs, the hybridized seeds, the chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, irrigation, is growing crops at the moment, but while it's doing it, it's depleting, it's destroying the soil, right? And so as it destroys the soil, more inputs are needed, speeding up the degradation of the soil, and eroding what millions of years have built up to be a fertile world into one that is no longer. So we now have about 33% of our planet's soils are not really capable of growing the foods that we would need them to grow anymore. Now, Montgomery dug into what plant and soil scientists had discovered a long time ago, but nobody was paying any attention to it because we were so busy treating soil as that component, you know? We just got to put stuff into it to make it do what we want it to do. And, you know, what he's challenging is this, is that we all know plants, what do? You know, they got leaves, right, that collect sunlight, and then they got roots that take in nutrients and water, and together with photosynthesis, they create sugars, which builds the plant and gives us food to eat, right? So, but what he said is that those roots that we think of as straws sucking in water and nutrients aren't straws at all. They're actually two-way highways. Yeah, they are taking in water and nutrients, but they are also doing something that they call exudates. I always forget that D in there. Exudates. They exude something. That's a two-way highway. They're taking in water, they're taking in nutrients, but they're also exuding something, exudates. And what are these exudates? They started looking into it, and they discovered that they're releasing carbohydrates, they're releasing proteins, they're releasing lipids, which are fats, into the soil right around the roots. Now, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, what does that sound like to you? Food. Why are they pumping food into the soil around their roots? Well, it isn't because they're nice. I mean, there's all these microorganisms that are gathering around the plants to feed on this food that they're pumping out. They're not doing it to be nice to them. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. They're not doing it because they're wasteful. If we know anything about evolution over the millions of years, it's made plants extremely efficient. They wouldn't be doing it if it's wasteful. They're doing it because they need to feed those microorganisms, in fact, very specific ones, so that they can work to produce the things that the plant needs to really grow. I mean, this is what you call symbiosis, right? Those microorganisms aren't going to be there if the plant isn't producing these exudates, and the plant isn't going to be able to be there if it isn't getting what those microorganisms are giving it. So what we've done is we've replaced the work of those exudates by just giving inputs. So, well, that's fine, right? That works. Well, guess what happens? What the research finds was when you start doing that, the plant stops producing exudates. I mean, it doesn't need to. It can grow a plant just because all this stuff that's pumped into the soil. The problem is it's not a fair exchange because the complexity and the fine intricacies that have been woven into this relationship with the microorganisms over a million years is much more complex, much more detailed than anything that we can replace with some fertilizers and some Roundup. You know, and it's not only for the growth of the plant, it's for the protection of the plant, it's for the retention of the water or the soil around it so that the plant can thrive. It's so much more than what we can replace. But when we give all those inputs, it shuts down the plants producing these exudates. So, and when that happens, then the soil gets unhealthier and healthier, meaning it's less able to grow the plant, meaning we have to put in more inputs, meaning the soil then gets less healthy, and you can see the spiral goes down. So taking this understanding, Montgomery went worldwide in search of farmers who are using this idea of soil health, understanding that there's already a system that exists between plants and soils and microorganisms. So people that are knowing that and embracing it to have it work for them and seeing what happens. All right, and let's catch just a couple of minutes. He was here just last month speaking at a conference, and let's hear him talk a little bit.
And that's a really important message to make. There's no silver bullet to rebuilding soil health. It's got to be tailored to the land, to the economy, to the crops, to the farm in question. It's really hard to prescribe detailed practices that follow these principles that would work everywhere. And in defense of that, let me show you, I think, four farmers who were all very successful at rebuilding the soil fertility of their land, but who had, you know, used different practices. First, I want to share with you is Dwayne Beck, who runs Dakota Lakes Research Farm through the University of South Dakota. I wanted to visit his farm first because the area of South Dakota where he farms is on the cover of my dirt book. I used a classic Dust Bowl era photograph. He's basically been spearheading an effort there to adopt no-till practices, and they've basically solved the blowing soil erosion problem in the regions that he's had a great influence on. They've adopted no-till cover crops and complex rotations, not all at once. They figured out a system over a few decades of experimentation, but they've gotten to a point where they're all now doing all three on his farm. And that's allowed him to reduce the use of diesel, fertilizer, and pesticide by more than half. Now, what are the big input costs on a modern farm in the US? Diesel, fertilizer, and pesticide. We could throw in patented seeds if we wanted to. But, you know, I'm happy stopping with diesel, fertilizer, and pesticide. If you can cut all that by half, that's a big savings. So what happened to his income? What happened to yields? Well, check out the numbers. These are sort of average numbers that he reported to me. There's more that I report in the book for more detailed things. But basically, their yields didn't go down, they went up. When they restored fertility to their land, their costs went down, and their harvest went up. That's a recipe for optimism. That's a recipe for wider adoption. This is when I really started to turn into an optimist in this kind of an issue, and I started to realize that the market forces that are operating on farmers today are such that if you can cut their input costs by changing practices but maintain their yields, that's a recipe for bigger, better adoption.
I love that. That's a recipe for optimism. Translate, that's a recipe for hope. Maybe we don't have to work so hard to make things grow. Maybe we need to stop focusing on one thing and discover, you know, the ornate system that is already at work. I love it. Montgomery was asked, was there something that we could all just do that would make our soils healthier around our homes or gardens, whatever? And he says, yeah. He says, if you're raking your leaves and bagging them up and then sending them off so someone else can use them to make their soil healthy, stop it. Your trees are trying to recycle their own nutrients to feed themselves, and you are starving them. You know, like I can sign up for doing one less chore in the fall. And, you know, anyway, some good examples of all this. I'd love for you to watch this whole video. It's quite long. You can, well, share it over social media, or you can just Google David Montgomery and freshwater and find it. But this idea that everything is connected is in there. The Bible sometimes gets beat up because you'll find these passages in the Old Testament where it says, and, you know, the iniquities, the wrongs, the sins of their parents shall be visited upon the children and their children's children, even unto the third and the fourth generation. You know, you read that and go, my goodness, what a vengeful God. I don't want to be a part of a God like that. But think about the minds that were saying this, right? These are thousands of years ago where they didn't have the advantages of science, but they were very much linked to the natural world. They saw how things were connected. They could not insulate themselves from it. They knew everything was connected. They knew that you couldn't change one thing and not have it affect others. They knew when something happened, some trauma, some sort of disorder, some sort of great joy or dysfunction, some sort of great hurt or tragedy happened at one time in someone's life, it was going to have reverberations next week and next month and next year and even in the next generation and even until the third and the fourth generation. It doesn't just go away. That's why when you separate yourself from the fabric of existence, when you start, you know, forgetting what it means to be part of this larger order, this larger system, it hurts us. But the same passage begins and says the loving kindness, the love of God extends even to the thousandth generation. That is the current. That is always there, pulling us back, calling us back, reminding us that there is hope, reminding us that when we are woven into the fabric, that there is hope, that there is love, there's a place to belong, that life works. Life works. There are a lot of examples of this hope that we can see and feel in our world, but the ones that come from nature seem to tell the story so well. So I'd just like us to see this video from George Monbiot. He's a journalist, a naturalist, an environmentalist, and I think it speaks for itself.
One of the most exciting scientific findings of the past half century has been the discovery of widespread trophic cascades. A trophic cascade is an ecological process which starts at the top of the food chain and tumbles all the way down to the bottom. And the classic example is what happened in the Yellowstone National Park in the United States when wolves were reintroduced in 1995. Now, we all know that wolves kill various species of animals, but perhaps we're slightly less aware that they give life to many others. Before the wolves turned up, they'd been absent for 70 years. That the numbers of deer, because there was nothing to hunt them, had built up and built up in the Yellowstone Park, and despite efforts by humans to control them, they'd managed to reduce much of the vegetation there to almost nothing. They'd just grazed it away. But as soon as the wolves arrived, even though they were few in number, they started to have the most remarkable effects. First, of course, they killed some of the deer, but that wasn't the major thing. Much more significantly, they radically changed the behavior of the deer. The deer started avoiding certain parts of the park, the places where they could be trapped most easily, particularly the valleys and the gorges. And immediately, those places started to regenerate. In some areas, the height of the trees quintupled in just 6 years. Bare valley sides quickly became forests of aspen and willow and cottonwood. And as soon as that happened, the birds started moving in. The number of songbirds and migratory birds started to increase greatly. The number of beavers started to increase because beavers like to eat the trees. And beavers, like wolves, are ecosystem engineers. They create niches for other species. And the dams they built in the rivers provided habitats for otters and muskrats and ducks and fish and reptiles and amphibians. The wolves killed coyotes. And as a result of that, the number of rabbits and mice began to rise, which meant more hawks, more weasels, more foxes, more badgers. Ravens and bald eagles came down to feed on the carrion that the wolves had left. Bears fed in it too, and their population began to rise as well, partly also because there were more berries growing on the regenerating shrubs. And the bears reinforced the impact of the wolves by killing some of the calves of the deer. Here's where it gets really interesting. the wolves changed the behavior of the rivers. They began to meander less. There was less erosion. The channels narrowed. More pools formed. More riffle sections, all of which were great for wildlife habitats. The rivers changed in response to the wolves. And the reason was that the regenerating forests stabilized the banks so that they collapsed less often, so that the rivers became more fixed in their course. Similarly, by driving the deer out of some places and the vegetation recovering on the valley sides, there was less soil erosion because the vegetation stabilized that as well. So the wolves, small in number, transformed not just the ecosystem of the Yellowstone National Park, this huge area of land, but also its physical geography.
Take a breath. On your Sunday paper on the outline, if you haven't looked at it, pull it out right now. You'll find there's a big fabric F on it. Just take your finger and touch any line anywhere on that F and start following it slowly. Just trace over it, see where it goes. Keep following it and take a breath as you go. And watch it lead. After a while, you'll find that you got where? Right back to where you started, right? And you can just keep going. Everything is connected. It's funny. I mean, as simple as that little picture is, some of you maybe never even noticed that that is just one line. It's deceiving. You just see loops and curves, but you don't realize that that is actually one line and all things are connected in it. Just think how hard it is for us to see that in our world, where it's so easy just to see our world as individual incidents, individual components that are there for us. We need to take that world view into more places. I've got hope for our soil and for our ecosystem because there are people who see that connectedness, that systems really are the truth behind it all. But that isn't an answer. That doesn't just make me rest in peace. What that does is call me to action and say, where can we take that and make that true in other parts of our world? In education, where it isn't just a matter of raising test scores, but it's a matter of the community from start to finish and how we embrace and love our children. Crime isn't just a matter of getting the right people locked up. It's a matter of the communities that raise people. The opportunities are there. It's unfortunately become a matter of the color of someone's body. It isn't about how we cure it by separating us with prisons, but how we are all one together through our community. I think about it in things like transportation, where we've had this illusion that the system is simply we got to move more cars to get people where they need to go, which means more roads and bigger roads and more fuel. Instead, we're starting to say, no, we need to move people. And maybe we don't need to move people so much. Maybe we just need the things that people need nearer to them. And there's new ways, new systems that need to be seen. We talk a lot here with Fabric about the idea that there's a unhelpful question, and then there's usually a better question. And the thing is that we ask a lot of unhelpful questions in our world, and what happens when you answer an unhelpful question? You get an unhelpful answer. I don't care what your answer is, you get an unhelpful one. So we work on looking for better questions, and the unhelpful question here is, what is wrong with this, that one thing? What is wrong with this? And that reflects a world that is all just a bunch of individual pieces. The better question might be, how does this system work? How does this system work? The pieces of this world can only be understood together with the connections between them all. You have the power to have this vision, to imagine the future, a world that is connected. And you have the ability, you have the power to breathe life into this world. You have permission to have hope.
Thanks for listening. We hope you take this conversation and keep it going. If we are adding value to your life, we appreciate your support of this work so we can engage more people in these conversations that matter for their real lives too. You can do that at fabricmpls.com/give. We'd also love to have you join us any Sunday morning at 10:30 at Field Community School in Minneapolis. That's at 4645 4th Avenue South. There are opportunities for kids of all ages to connect to. Learn more by searching Fabric Minneapolis.